Okay, good morning, everybody. Welcome to another New Energy Chinwag with myself, John Massey, and Charlie Bratton. Hi, Charlie.
Good day, everybody.
And also today, we've got a guest, which is good news. We've got Ryan Lamberg, who is a sustainability consultant to the National Biodiesel Board. And you're calling us from New York.
Actually, calling you from Vermont.
Vermont. Oh, very nice. How are the leaves at the moment?
Gorgeous. We're in peak season.
Yeah, I was in Boston for a little while. I was working there for a year, and certainly the leaves at this time of year were worth a visit. Anyway, that's not the subject of our podcast today. As the name suggests, Ryan, National Biodiesel Board. Now, I guess I'll make a few words of introduction in a few minutes. From over here in Europe, certainly diesel is not a very popular word these days. We're definitely trying to phase that out. Biofuels is an interesting one. I mean, it was all the rage in Europe for a little while, and then it kind of dropped off the agenda a little bit because of concerns about obviously life cycle emissions and sources of feedstock and that kind of stuff. So I'm sure we'll get into that. But it's still a big chunk of fuel. It's still a big chunk of fuel additives and emissions reduction. So it'd be interesting to get a perspective on from the other side of the pond, and also a perspective maybe globally on how you see different regions. So I guess to begin with, I mean, a few words of introduction, I guess, from yourself and some perspectives on this, and then we'll just kind of see how we go and we'll throw some questions in.
Sure. Well, Charlie and John, thank you. Honored to be here. So a few words of background on myself. I grew up in a city, Baltimore, and spent most of my professional life out in the Bay Area in California. I had an opportunity to live and work in Nicaragua, where I first heard of the word biodiesel. And and the vision at that time was, you know, wait a minute. So the rest of Central America is addicted to Venezuelan oil, and the regimes that are bolstered there by that oil. So perhaps something like biodiesel could mature into regenerative of the forests that have been cut down, and bringing back some economy to people that could be using the boost, the economic boost, and the jobs that come with it. And so I returned to the U.S. from that experience and started a biodiesel company. So in Northern California, helped build a 25 million gallon facility, and spent more time doing some other energy related startups and energy efficiency. And about a decade ago, returned to the biodiesel world in part as a contractor. And really, it's been a kind of a transportation focused decade, where I've been largely working for the National Biodiesel Board and helping represent them. They are an industry council in the United States that represents all the biodiesel as well as renewable diesel. And we can kind of get into definitions later.
Yeah, that would be good. I guess that was one of my questions was, when you mentioned diesel to some people, they just think about diesel in their cars. But I guess what would be good to get a scope, are we talk about the types of transportation we're talking about? Are we talking everything from cars to trucks to planes to ships? And also, might not be what you represent specifically, but also ethanol is obviously a big chunk of the whole kind of biofuels picture. So it'd be interesting to get some perspectives on that as well. So maybe the first one, I mean, in terms of the type of how you see transportation.
Well, so let's define the word biodiesel, or maybe you want to, maybe that would help. So biofuels, under that umbrella of biofuels, you really have different branches. So things that are a diesel replacement would be a biodiesel, a renewable diesel, which is going to be made from the same feedstocks. Those feedstocks are oils and fats. And really, it's a different process. And you end up producing a slightly different chemical. In one case, you're producing a chemical that mimics a diesel fuel. Diesel ASTM in the U.S., 975 is the standard for diesel fuel. And renewable diesel makes a same standard type of product, meets that same spec. Where biodiesel meets a different ASTM spec, and is done with less energy and can be blended and at lots of different levels with diesel fuel, but typically is done from B5 to B20, as well as up to B50 and higher, but has different specifications and other cold flow requirements. So that would be the biofuels under biodiesel. And then there's ethanols, of course, made from both sugar and corn. It really comes from starches, right? So there's also cellulosic ethanol, which was a hot topic for a while and has kind of fallen off only because largely we've grown so much corn and so much sugar that we have lots of ethanol from those initial plants. And then you also have other biofuels like renewable natural gas that, of course, is coming from methane capture of bio, whether it's bio waste or manures. And then a fourth tier under the umbrella of biofuels would be...
When you say natural gas, you're talking about, you're not talking about natural gas drilled from underground, you're talking about biogas and biomethane.
Right, biomethane. That's right. Renewable natural gas is what it's called here.
Yeah.
And then the fourth tier would be bioenergy, which is really kind of driving turbines, and that's really coming from pellets and trees, different direction altogether. So those are the four categories. Largely, I'm focused on the replacement of diesel fuel with biodiesel and biomass-based diesels.
Mm. And in terms of the transport sectors, what kind of vehicles is that mainly replacing in at the moment?
Right. So you have generally two categories of internal combustion and compression engine vehicles. You've got diesels and gasoline. So I think one of those misunderstood concepts is the scale of the problem.
Mm.
And I think we need to constantly or should generally reflect on that for just a second. We have 1.3 billion vehicles in the entire globe right now.
Yeah.
Billion. We're selling 100 million a year, right? So of those 100 million that we're selling, by far the vast majority are either gas or diesel vehicles, right? So what we're talking about is a replacement of the fuel in an infrastructure and in a vehicle that currently exists. So that highlights one of biofuel's best qualities, which is the now, and understanding that kind of decarbonization from a now perspective using today's vehicles and today's infrastructure is key to understanding how biofuels fits in to the energy
transition. If I might just interrupt there, Ryan, are you saying that biodiesel can use existing engines? There's no modifications needed. There's no special adaptations needed. They exist. We're quite happy to use, or the industry is quite happy for biodiesel just to be injected into existing engines.
So you've asked two questions, Charlie. The first one is, can it be used in all of diesel equipment and gasoline equipment for ethanol? So again, under that umbrella, two different fuels replacing two different, gasoline or diesel. But yes, it can be used in diesel equipment today, same infrastructure, without modification to the engine. And in the U.S. anyway, about 90% or greater of the medium and heavy duty trucks, and that's where the vast majority of diesel is used in the U.S., have come out and said, yes, we accept B20 as a baseline. So
that's a blending.
That's a blended fuel.
You're not using pure biofuels. It's blended with...
It's blended, although there are cases and municipalities. So taking New York City, for example, they have a fleet of about 30,000 vehicles. That's light duty, medium duty, and of course, every duty cycle from, road cleaning to police and construction. But of their... approximately half of those are diesel vehicles, and they're using biodiesel and blends from B5 to B100. So not in all cases do you need to do that, but the warranty issues is a bit of a stumbling block although there really shouldn't be warranty. They warranty the vehicle, not the fuel. And as long as the fuel is meeting spec and treated properly, the real issue historically had been, you know, making the fuel and meeting quality specs. That's no longer the issue. The biodiesel and renewable diesel producers are producing things at spec at the same quality specifications and meeting the same standards that diesel does on a regular basis when it's tested at retail. The issue is how it's treated from when it's produced to getting it all the way into the fuel tank. And there are times when there might be water or mold in tanks that can create issues. But as long as you're following standard operating procedures, getting that fuel from the producer into the fuel tank, there's millions of miles and millions of vehicles that are using biodiesel today without problem.
And these New York ones, do they have their own filling stations for biodiesel? How do you physically get the biodiesel into the tank?
So again, that's one of the nice things about biodiesel is that it can move along the same infrastructure. There's been tests in pipelines, so not necessarily higher blends in pipelines, but certainly when biodiesel moves by barge, rail, or truck, it's moving along the same pathways as petroleum diesel would. And so blended in very similar infrastructure. So in some cases, there might be large retail could buy 100% biodiesel and then have in-house blending. But for the most part, it's moved upstream so that the blend at the blending racks, you're now blending and picking up pre-blended fuel where right there they're storing the B100 and blending it at the terminal racks.
I guess there's a couple of obvious questions that people are probably kind of shouting at the audio at the moment. What one will be around sustainability, so the feedstock, the source, which we'd need to address. And I guess the other one is, if you're burning biodiesel, let's assume, for sake of argument, we assume that the carbon sustainability is fine. You're still going to have things like NOx emissions from just the fact it's internal combustion. And the other thing that you could choose potentially is EVs, battery electric vehicles, sure. Or even potentially in future hydrogen vehicles. So again, I guess the sustainability side, the feedstock side, would be interesting, both from a US perspective and maybe how you see that compared to other territories. But then also, how you see going forwards the kind of biofuel side fitting alongside or competing head to head with particularly battery vehicles, I guess, which are growing quite quickly in many markets.
Right. Well, it's a great question. So I think, again, that I'm one apt to talk about that big perspective. And we started some of the conversation talking about 1.3 billion vehicles and selling, you know, millions of gallons of petroleum into a system every second, right? And in the U.S., we're using approximately 200 billion gallons of petroleum every year annually in the U.S. So that's about 60 billion to move on-road trucking as well as shipping, aviation, off-road. That's 60 billion gallons a year. And on the gas side, it's moved over the last 5 years from about 135 to about 145 billion gallons of gasoline. So in the U.S. and into your context of electric vehicles, which are need to be and are certainly super popular as people are talking about, but let's put that context into perspective. We've sold in the U.S. 1.3, 1.5 million electric vehicles. That's in a sea of 270 million vehicles that are on our roads today. So it's certainly less than 1% of what we're doing. Certainly the sales rates are increasing in certain markets, but you can see that to replace 270 million vehicles where we spent a decade to get to 1.5 million, it's gonna take a very, very long time. And of course, diesel vehicles are often on the roads for a lot longer than 10 years, more often on average 20 years. So the turnover to get there is going to be difficult.
Are there any targets in the States about stopping selling vehicles? Because over in Europe, we've got, I mean, like the UK has said, after 2035, you won't be able to sell at least pure petrol or gasoline, pure diesel vehicles.
So we're following, kind of looking across the pond as well to some of those types of mandates. And oftentimes it's California really setting the high bar. And they've recently set a standard in California for light duty cars to be to stop selling internal combustion as of 2035. And then for heavy duty to stop selling new internal combustion or diesel by 2045. Now these are harsh, not harsh mandates, but I think it's a tool, right? And I think we should talk about what other tools exist to get to where we want to go and where we need to go collectively. And so I think we'll touch upon that. But you also asked about sustainability, and a lot of topics come up around fuels. So I guess in terms of that big picture thinking, we talked about scale, but I think context would be the other big picture point that is often misunderstood. So one example would be, we talk about China with an explosion of EVs. Maybe they've sold about 5, even 10 million EVs. And yet what powers their EV is often a non-renewable grid. And yet they're also claiming, but we don't know how, that it's going to be all renewable in 50 or 60 years. But they're a far cry from that today. U.S. biofuels is part of that context story. And perhaps to get into European biofuels for a second, I should probably start there. The biomass-based diesel, that's biodiesel, renewable diesel, that market in Europe was the first to really embrace biofuels as the prodigal son, right? Let's replace our diesel, let's replace our gasoline with these biofuels. And so they built a large amount of capacity, about 3.5 billion gallons of biodiesel, renewable diesel production is in Europe. But if you look at a global map, you'll quickly see that Europe's agricultural footprint isn't necessarily there to support that type of production scale. And so what did Europe do as a general rule? They started buying feedstocks from outside of Europe to meet those capacity. And that feedstock was up to, at height maybe a decade ago, 30 or 40% of the palm oil that exists. And so, of course, if you're a European environmentalist, you would be up in arms against the direct impacts of renewable diesel and biodiesel on the environment because of an importation of palm oil and destruction of rainforest. That is waning under new rules in Europe, which I think is a good thing, putting downward pressure on that palm oil and trying to shut that door. The U.S. has always shut that door on palm oil. So we have a federal program called the Renewable Fuels Standard, the RFS in the U.S. We've never allowed palm oil to be considered as biodiesel in that program. And then California's programs and Oregon's programs, other state programs have also said that palm oil doesn't meet their carbon threshold to qualify for those programs. So again, two different stories. And then when you look at that global picture, the global map, you can see that the U.S. has a very large agricultural footprint. So we have much greater capacity, and we're doing so at every year at a smaller footprint on the ground, but with higher yields. No one knew that we would grow 200, 250 bushels an acre of corn a couple decades ago. No one thought we would get the yields that we're getting out of soy, and we're doing that with less inputs and on less farmland than ever before. And when we do that effectively, to really understand the context of U.S. biofuels, when we do that effectively, build higher yields on smaller footprint, we actually decrease the pressure to destroy rainforest elsewhere if we're creating lots of food and lots of oil. I think the other context to really understand around biofuels is this is the kind of the aha moment that most people don't understand, is that there is no food versus fuel in the U.S. There is food and fuel. A soybean is 80% protein, 20% oil. If you ask any soybean farmer, they're growing that product for the protein because of global protein demand. We have 7.5 billion people on the planet. More and more of those people are moving to cities. They're eating more meat. That is an issue that needs to be dealt with. But the point is that global protein demand has not slowed down. It hasn't slowed down because of COVID. It's not going away. And when we grow all that soy protein to feed animals, we have this 20% oil. We've been absorbing as much of that oil into the food process as we possibly can, into mayonnaise, into frying oil. But of course, we're frying less food or eating less mayonnaise. And so there's always been this somewhat of a glut of oil. China has wanted our whole beans. And so we've shipped a lot of our whole beans over there because, of course, they crush it and use that oil for their own frying. But we have a way of capturing this excess, this byproduct. And in the U.S., the biodiesel story is really a recycling story of global protein demand. It's not just soy oil, animal fats and tallows, canola oils, inedible corn oils that come off of ethanol. And even ethanol has a very similar story, even though it's often vilified, and it shouldn't be, but it is often vilified because in the U.S. they say, well, 40% of corn goes to an ethanol facility. Well, it does, but 20% of that corn, once processed, still goes to feed animals. And so 60-70% of corn is still feeding animals because of global protein demands. And we do that very effectively and efficiently here in the U.S. So,
There's a whole bunch of kind of into the life cycle things with soil, for example. I mean, I don't know if that wasn't going into fuel, could that replace palm oil demand, for example? So is there still a substitutional issue whereby if we didn't use it for fuel, we can actually cut down is probably the wrong word. We're talking about forests. We could reduce the usage of other oils which are damaging. I guess it's where you draw the boundaries of the life cycle become interesting.
And it's a great question, John. And when you think about global markets and how they occur, there is that substitution issue has reared its head, certainly a lot as one of those fallback positions. But the studies from Argonne National Laboratory and other folks studying this have shown a very, very, very small impact, if at all, less than 1% of that substitutability between soy oil and palm oil from a U.S. perspective in terms of what those drivers are. But I certainly know that that exists. And I think, you know, in terms of life cycle analysis, so many schemes have been built, right? There's a European scheme, Globium, there's the GREET model. And I think at this point, we simply have to tip our hats to probably the strongest environmental regulatory agency in the world, which is the California Resources Board. And if we can believe them, you don't have to believe me, right? So California has said that through the GREET model and through lots and lots of study, we're going to put carbon intensity scores on certain fuels from different feedstocks and different pathways. And on average, all that biomass-based diesel flowing into California today, we haven't touched on the policies yet, but that's on average around a 70% carbon reduction. That's on par with anything that they're doing on the EV side. Again, we need everything. That's going to be my major theme here. But the carbon story around biofuels is a success story in the U.S., and CARB California has proven that.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I guess interesting your take on the view that in some ways light transport is kind of easier to solve because we can do it with EVs, but the difficult stuff is things like maritime and aviation and so on. So what's your view in terms of a future that the light stuff does go EV, and actually the best use of things like bio oils in that case is actually for synthetic fuels, for the difficult stuff, the stuff you can't do with a battery? I mean, can you see that as a way that the industry moves, that the kind of the light vehicle story is kind of, you have to concede that, but it's the heavier stuff and the particularly the the as I say, things like aviation and shipping, that's that becomes the bit that you can't do in another way.
Right. Yeah, I would, in general, I would agree with you, John. I think that what's happened though in the last decade is that the academic view is what you've just said. That's what's going to happen. We're going to be all EV for light duty. We struggle with the medium and heavy duty, certainly with the very heavy duty shipping and aviation, and that's where biofuels have a role to play. Now, as long as we're at the table, I feel like I know that our carbon intensity and our usefulness today is being proven by California, by Oregon, in a way that is much more powerful than simply a niche, more of a niche use in aviation and shipping. Now, just those two sectors alone will consume more biofuels than we have or we could probably produce. Mm. So if we get relegated to those sectors alone, and that satisfies the belief system that that's where we should play, that's okay. But the truth, I think, is much harder to face, which is, again, we have 1.3 billion vehicles in the world. We're not selling nearly enough electric vehicles. We're not moving this dial nearly fast enough. And my problem and the reason I want to get on this show and talk to the world about this issue is because right now I think we're leaving some great carbon opportunities on the cutting room floor.
Mm. Yeah, so, Ryan, sorry to interrupt you there, but it does seem as though your solution or the biodiesel solution is one for the here and now. And it just strikes me, I mean, it does seem as though perhaps it's America seems to have been ahead of Europe on perhaps a little bit less naive about some of the wider implications than Europe. And in some ways, it would seem to be a solution that I would have thought the Treasury would like. It would seem to be a taxable commodity. It's real. It's not electrons. It's something that... How does it compare, for example, if you to fill a tank with biodiesel as if you were to go to the pumps and just fill it with normal diesel? Is there a cost implication to using it?
So cost, I think even more importantly, energy density, which is often forgotten in the conversation. So that's the how much BTU power per square foot, right? So biodiesel has a very similar profile than diesel fuel in terms of its energy content, about 120,000 BTU per gallon versus diesel, which might be 128,000. So a couple percentage less, and that's gallon per gallon, not blended at all. If it's blended, of course, it's almost the same. Cost implications would be very different depending on each niche market, right? So in California, because of, and I hope to get into this, is the Low Carbon Fuel Standard, or what often called the Clean Fuel Program, but in California, the Low Carbon Fuel Standard is its name, has been implemented since 2011. You can get biodiesel for less than diesel. And renewable diesel might sell it at a small premium, but in terms of its carbon reduction potency, when you're talking about using the same infrastructure and same vehicles, again, 99% of vehicles in that class 7 and 8 are still diesel. We're still selling 35,000 diesels a month. We still have about 10 million diesels on the road in the U.S.
When we talk about costs, does that involve subsidy? Are there kind of credits or certificates or some kind of emission subsidy that's helping that cost be low?
Sure. So in California, the Low Carbon Fuel Standard is putting a price on carbon. Mm-hmm. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
So California is putting a price on carbon. And within that Low Carbon Fuel Standard, that price is up near $200 a ton. So yeah, absolutely. Does that reflects at almost a dollar a gallon and sometimes more in terms of the difference. And that is what's changing the market dramatically. So to pause for a second and talk about the Low Carbon Fuel Standard is really important. And it's not necessarily, let's say it was implemented in 2011. What it is a market-based approach that says we're going to reduce the carbon intensity of fuels by a certain curve over time. What is now scheduled to be 30%, well, 20% by 2030, 20% reduction by 2030. And there's new, there's already some action towards looking towards 2035 and reducing it further. Okay, so that curve in a market-based approach sends a market signal to bring in the lowest carbon alternative to petroleum the fastest way possible. And so in the first 9 years of this implementation of this program, what has created more than approximately 50 million metric tons of carbon reduction? Biofuels, ethanol, biodiesel, renewable natural gas. You combine those, that's about 85% of the credits to date. Now, electrification has also grown from what was 1% of that pool back in 2011 to approximately 15 to 17% of that pool today, and it's continuing to grow. So it's a success story for all these alternative fuels.
It's a very good news story.
What is often overlooked is that biofuels is the backbone, and that's the same for Oregon, and would be the same for other programs. I'm sorry, Charlie, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just agreeing with you, saying it's actually a very good news story, and I'm grateful that you're conveying it, because it's sometimes overlooked, certainly on this side of the Atlantic, that the strides that have been made there. Obviously, America seems to have been slightly ahead of the curve than we've managed on this side, on the European side.
Well, you know, yes and no. I mean, again, Europe embraced biofuels early on, but perhaps didn't see America learned from Europe's experience by putting those guardrails on, so that we were focusing more on our agricultural footprint and the byproducts of global protein demand from U.S. crops. Really, the renewable fuel standard, the federal program, was built as an energy independence type of program, not a carbon reduction tool, but it turned out to be both.
Is that any, is it a federal thing or a California thing?
So that's what you need to kind of contextualize. There is a federal program called the Renewable Fuel Standard that would occur for all states. And what that is a volumetric approach to biofuels. And it creates buckets, a certain amount of biodiesel, advanced fuels, and all biodiesel meets that term advanced. Advanced in the U.S. has a strict definition. It means at least a 50% carbon reduction as compared to petroleum. All biodiesel in the United States meets that and exceeds that. On average today, we're closer to about an 80%, 86% carbon reduction when you look at all the feedstocks and what California is consuming. So it's a great story there. Ethanol also has to meet certain standards, but fills different buckets. And then, of course, renewable natural gas does that. That's a federal program. And then in terms of fuel programs, you have on the West Coast, California with the low carbon fuel standard, Oregon with a very similar program, and hats off to Oregon, because not everybody is willing to kind of take a great idea off the shelf and replicate it, but Oregon was, and slapped a new name on it, the Clean Fuels Program, and replicates very much what California has done. And their story is very similar. So you'll see a lot of biofuels as the backbone of that program, but also massive growth in electrification. BC has done that, and Washington State is in the middle of considering that. Colorado and New York and other states along the East Coast are also learning from those examples and certainly doing some analysis to possibly embrace those same type of policies. But then in the Midwest states, you have a different approach, which is that, like, Minnesota has mandated B20 or 20% biodiesel in all its diesel fuel. Illinois has created incentives, as has Iowa. And so they have growing amount of blends, approximately 10% up to 20% blends in those states, but with different policies.
Interesting because my understanding is that the places that seem to be using it the most are not the same places that are growing the stuff. You'd imagine that the producers would be quite keen on growing the market as well and actually implementing it in their own states. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the politics and the kind of the practicalities are around that.
Well, that's true, right? Those examples I just mentioned of Minnesota and Illinois, where there's plenty of access to those fuels, they've implemented some good policies to incentivize those fuels. But, you know, all of those fuels, just to answer your original question, would meet that volumetric approach for the renewable fuel standard. And then it's on the West Coast where you have these additional programs, low carbon fuel standards. Now Canada, not just BC, is implementing a very similar type thing. Brazil is pursuing that. So, yes, those are great examples for Europe to learn from. But it embraced some of these things, and it's been hard to, I think, dial back that agricultural footprint story for Europe and get rid of the palm. And of course, you know, it did its damage by having that conversation and palm being Indonesian, you know, rainforest destruction being on people's minds when they associate it with biodiesel.
Well, I mean, I guess
not our story, but that had been your story.
Yeah, I mean, I guess another in Europe, what we're seeing certainly is, certainly in the private car sector, is we're seeing a real collapse in diesel, not so much on the gasoline, the petrol side. And then obviously we're seeing EV growth, but the petrol to diesel, gasoline to diesel ratio changing, driven not so much by the bio side, but just the VW diesel scandal, frankly. And then I guess also the question that still kind of lurks is the scalability of all this. So certain percent is fine, but if you're then saying, well, we want to replace 100% of transport, then we presumably do start to run into challenges in terms of it's no longer just surplus biomass. Then you're into, well, where's that all going to come from? So presumably there are, even in the states, there must be some limits in terms of how far you can go in terms of scale.
Right. No, John, that's a great point. I mean, let me talk about scale for a second in the context of California. So in 2011, the entire state was burning less than 15 million gallons of this term biomass-based diesel, renewable diesel and biodiesel, less than 15 million gallons. In 2019, the state consumed 830 million gallons. That's approximately 25% of its diesel pool. If you just look at the last several years and you avoid looking at the massive growth in the first couple of years of that program, biomass-based diesels are on track to replace every gallon of diesel fuel in the state of California by 2025.
But that's using existing supply, or does that require...
So to your point, that would be about 3.5 billion gallons, and that would probably consume most of what the U.S. has to offer as low-hanging fruit, right? Wow. So the feedstock issue certainly needs to be front and center, but we do have new opportunities to grow feedstocks. And I think tackling that is that back to that aha moment for many, which is to understand that up to now, all of those feedstocks are coming from global protein demand. So they're all in excess. They're not being thrown away. There are uses for them, but generally it's been in excess of this global protein demand, even fats and tallows, right? You want the meat. Europe loves Argentinian beef. But what happens to those carcasses to be able to use those oils and fats for biodiesel isn't because we have we really want to drink tallows. It's because, you know, you didn't grow the beef for that. You grew it for the meat, and we have the excess oil from that global protein demand. So that would be a story of that. The same with used cooking oil. We have to face the feedstock question, but there are some really cool companies and great ideas, not only You know, there's one called Carinata, which is like a soybean that's largely protein, you know, maybe 60% protein, 40% oil. And it's grown in parts of the world that have less water, less access to water, but still creating protein and filling that protein demand, but not needing new forests to do so, and creating excess oils for fuels.
What happened to algae a few years ago when I was looking into biofuels? Yeah. Algae was kind of where hydrogen is in terms of hype at the moment, but it kind of disappeared. Yeah.
When I first got into this, John, I too went to lots of conferences. It's been one of those technologies that's 10 years off every 10 years.
Yeah, like fusion. Yeah,
it's like fusion. You can't get it for free. But I would say, you know, the big shift and the gorilla in the room is what's happening globally, in part because of the pandemic, right? To your point, the world is flooded with jet fuel because no one's flying. That jet fuel is basically diesel fuel. So it's putting a downward pressure. We've got lots and lots of diesel fuel flooding the market. What's happening by those big refiners is that many of them are looking to utilize their low-hanging, underutilized resource, like the oldest refinery. And instead of spending the money to shut it down, they're going to spend the money to swap out the feedstocks and boost it back up with renewable diesel. And when they do that, of course, they don't have to pay another producer, and they can capture some of that money that was going into the renewable fuel standard federally. And in California, where a lot of that product is flowing almost exclusively because of the low carbon fuel standard, and into Oregon, they would capture that price differential based on carbon. So instead of spending $3 to a biodiesel producer, they would capture that themselves. So you see a lot of new announcements. Jacobson and others are tracking all of that, but there's a lot of renewable diesel coming online, and it's going to initially suck up a lot of those feedstocks. And so, but if we can keep pushing for low carbon fuel policies and start sending long-term market signals, which is what the industry needs, then products like algal processes to produce these oils can exist based on those opportunities. Of course, most of the algal today has been produced and then it goes into pharmaceutical grade or other, you know, foods and cosmetics, because it's just better. But I think the technology has come along. It just hasn't been at scale for fuels because we haven't created the markets for them yet.
Higher margin stuff.
Could I ask a question, Ryan, about a consumer type of perspective? If I don't work for New York State or I don't have access to one of these 30,000 diesels, I've just got a normal diesel, but I'd like to fill it with biodiesel the next time. Do I just go to a regular filling station, and is there a special nozzle with biodiesel written on it with a green label of some kind? And I just carry on and fill the tank up and then pay my money. Is it as simple as that, or is it something a bit more complex than that?
No, I would love to spend more time traveling the countryside of Europe to determine where and how you buy biodiesel there. But I can tell you that, you know, you have to kind of put on that global perspective for a second. I know that 50% of light duty vehicles, your diesel, you know, it might be diesel vehicle. But in the U.S., less than 2%, maybe closer to 1% of our vehicles, and those are really just the pickup trucks, are relegated to diesel. We see that 40 billion gallons of diesel fuel consumed in class 7 and 8 vehicles. That's where the majority of it is, fueling off-road and on-road things that you wouldn't drive. So yes, Charlie, you could, I mean, in the States, and a few years ago, I was driving around in my old Mercedes, filling up with high blend levels of biodiesel and driving down the road without changing anything in my vehicle. But I'd much rather see a large fleet of 2,000 diesel vehicles fueling up today with even 1% biodiesel. Why so low? Because I know that once you put the infrastructure in to put in 1%, all I have to do is turn the dial and I can get 5%. And then I turn it again when you're really comfortable and happy with the price. And in fact, it's a better fuel. We're not talking about something that's a worse fuel. It's a better fuel, not only for the environment, but for your engine, offers lots of lubricity benefits, offers other benefits when done well. And you can just keep turning that volume up. B20, as I said, 90% of our OEMs here would accept that in the U.S. And only in you know, it's unnamed European brands that are have kind of struggled with that. But the science isn't there to dispute those benefits. I think to your scalable issue, John, though, I think that the fix means that we need to double down on everything. And we need to do it today. I mean, every day we wake up with another article that we're not going to get Arctic ice, that IPCC reports, you know, give us 10 years. So we need everything. And this is not an argument about why one thing is better than another, but it's to try to support the story of biofuels, because the back of the napkin thinking should be biogenic, that every gallon displaces petroleum, and we can do so on smaller footprints. Now, of course, we do have global issues like deforestation of forests and poorly managed agriculture. We have to handle all that, but we can do that. There's been lots of examples under different administrations when we put in rules and follow those rules to stop burning rainforests and helping farmers to create higher yields on smaller footprints, creating both food and fuel.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. I mean, it's to me, that's a very similar issue than, for example, in the battery electric world, there's lots of criticism about things like cobalt mining and so on. And my answer to that is always, well, fix the mining. Don't not use something because the mining is terrible. We're not going to live in a world where we never mine anything. The key to it is fix the mining practices and sort out. If you're going to source minerals, source them properly. I mean, just back to Charlie's question. I mean, here in Europe, here in the UK, certainly, if you fill up your car with diesel, you're filling it up with, I'm not sure what the percentage is, 4 or 5% biodiesel these days. You're not picking a pump. It's just mandated that that's what's going into the fuel. I think in Europe, certain countries are slightly different. I think other countries, you can go to a pump, which is more a specifically higher blend. But certainly in the UK, it's kind of the consumer isn't aware, but it's there. There's a scheme around.
So you blend up to, in the US, up to 5% biodiesel into that gallon, and you can still call it diesel fuel. So there wouldn't be any label, there wouldn't be any recognition of that. Above that, in the US, we have to have a different label. And again, I don't know how that works, and to your point, there are different states. I think you touched on something like the nomenclature issue is probably something for a European context we should tackle for a second. There's probably a lot of the verbiage around first generation and second generation biofuels. To me, that kind of it hits a button for me, because first generation is considered, you know, soy or canola, right? And second generation is often considered dedicated feedstocks for biofuel production. And it's just the reverse. Dedicated feedstocks are almost impossible to do because you're only creating one product, a feedstock for a fuel, or a feedstock for something, where those quote unquote first generation are really creating multiple products, starches, fats, oils, and protein that the world's demanding. And it's in excess where we're able to capture that and turn that into bio. Another one of those nomenclature issues, I don't know if you struggle with this in Europe, we talk a lot about zero emissions. Do you guys talk about that a lot?
Net zero, zero carbon.
And to me, you know, when you think of transportation, and I pose this question to both of you, can you give me an example of zero emission?
Yeah, as I say, nothing is ever zero emissions. I mean, you've got everything that's made.
You wake up in the morning and you drink your coffee, and that cost carbon, right? It got to my cup. Costing carbon right now. There is no zero. And so because there's no zero, I think everything is in a slightly gray area. And that's why I would also say that, you know, the internal combustion engine, which has been especially vilified and for good reason, because we need to get rid of petroleum, but the technologies that have gone into both gasoline in terms of catalytic converters and on the diesel side with DPFs, SOCs, DOCs, and SCRs, and these are the catalytic converters and converting all that NOx and PM down to near zero levels, have been vilified, and for good reason. Again, Volkswagen didn't do justice, but in the States and in California, where they're testing and looking at that, we've driven over the last 30, 50 years, the tailpipe emissions to near zero levels. And the proof is in the pudding. If you look at the air basin of LA, which you couldn't see through in the 80s, is now mostly clear on most days. So that proves that the tailpipe emissions are much, much better. I think we can use advances and advancements in technology, but replace the fuels, and we have to replace petroleum, but we can still use the same infrastructures and the same vehicles, maximize those. Meanwhile, let's plan for new infrastructures, new things. Volkswagen, in their destruction of the diesel engine, had to buy into the United States with $150 billion worth of funds to rectify that problem. A lot of that money has been spent on electrification infrastructure. $150 billion and 5 years later, we still don't have enough to support the light duty fleets that are out there. We have a long way to go. We need more Teslas. We need all of that excitement. But in the US, the 1.3 million, again, fantastic, doubling down every year of electric vehicles, but 60% of that's in California, where they've given tons of money to make that opportunity exist. And other states aren't seeing that ramp up. So let's push on that as fast as we can. But meanwhile, let's also push on ethanol, which we know displaces petroleum, which is a lower carbon footprint and can get lower with over time. But we're flooded with it. So why not maximize it? What disturbs me is that we're leaving opportunities on the cutting room floor when the world is falling apart with fires and everything else. We should be maximizing every resource at our fingertips to reduce carbon today.
Yeah, it's hard to hard to question that one. I'm looking on my list of things to cover. We've gone through. I mean, we've gone through quite a lot. We've used up a fair bit of time.
I guess I would end, and I think I've touched on it because I just had a couple notes myself. I always like to end on the solution side, right?
Yeah.
So we've talked about the low carbon fuel standard and clean fuel policy, which I think are huge, and those opportunities exist. We need to do more on carbon capture and storage, right? We need to do more on sequestration of current carbon. And if you hear brilliant minds speak about solutions, what are the typical solutions you often hear, or that I often hear? I think, ironically, they'll talk a lot about electrification, but then the solutions are often bio-based. They talk about growing more algae in our oceans and regenerative agriculture and our soils and doing things like cork. And, you know, almost every potential solution right now, and I still think we would need millions of years, unfortunately, but we need to remember and recall that bio-based solutions, whether it's the biofuels or the carbon capture and storage, we can be maximizing those by pushing hard on that tie-in and supporting. We shouldn't be vilifying our American farmers or any global farmers. They're just trying to survive. We should be helping them grow more on a smaller footprint.
I mean, I guess on that, one random question that I had occurred to me that suddenly popped back into my head was with food, one of the, and meeting protein demand and so on, there's certainly a lot of interest, I know, over in the States and also countries over here in what do you call it? It's kind of not growing. It's kind of growing food in a lab, kind of lab based.
Yeah,
meat,
right.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah. Impossible burgers. Cells
where you have one stem cell and you've got almost unlimited growth. I mean, it occurs to me, and I'd be interested to know if anyone's looking at this in fuels. Can you use the same technology to potentially produce kind of unlimited fuel? Is that something that exists, or is that kind of something that's just kind of popped into my head as science fiction?
No, I mean, I think it's a great question. I, you know, it's a good example of there is no free lunch. So I still think that the Beyond Burgers and all this other meat that they're growing is still based on peas and other food based products. It doesn't come out of thin air. But yeah, I think to your point, there's a lot of focus on green chemistry, and using things like, enzymes to do things faster, better, easier, and cleaner. And those technologies are moving forward. I think they're exciting. And you know, some of the pushback from the far left would be, you know, let's stop eating meat altogether. Cows and all this meat's bad. Let's go all vegetarian. And there is a certain amount of point to that. But if we were all to try to consume the protein we need globally, 7.5 billion people, we would need to grow quite a bit of protein to do that. And it might actually take up more land than less. Now, I think that we should all be cutting way back on our meat, probably eating once a week or twice a week at most. And there's probably a sustainable level, but even regenerative agriculture and the people that are on the edge of understanding how to bring back our soils tell us that we need chickens to peck the soil. We need cows to do all of that. So there's a sustainable level of meat consumption, I think, that would dial back the pressure on some of the forests. And at the same time, what we need to do, we've got all the policies out there. We just simply need to enforce those policies with those countries like Indonesia and others. And it's not their fault. They simply want to grow their way back to an economic par with the rest of the world or the rest of the developed world.
Yeah, I mean, I think the meat vegetarian is probably a whole other podcast in itself. down that wormhole. But I think one thing that's come out from this chat, I think the connection between food and potential fuel, not in the negative way, but in terms of we're going to have more food because there's more people. And hence, if we're producing more food and we've got byproducts in that food, using that for fuel, that is kind of one of the things I guess I'm taking away from this, is that there's a synergy between the two, and it doesn't have to be a negative synergy in every case. In fact, the goal is to make it as positive a synergy as you can, and be cooperative rather than competitive, if that makes sense.
And, you know, take another region as an example, South America. They also have about a 2 billion gallon biodiesel market there, but they're largely dependent on soy. And why are they dependent on soy? Really because of, again, global pressure, global demand for protein. They've been exporting that soy to Asian countries and growing lots to feed animals for Argentinian beef and Brazilian beef that Europe often might import. So I think the story there can also be very positive. To your point, John, we just simply need to help these countries in a certain way enforce the laws on the books so that we're not destroying rainforests, but understand that perspective that global protein demand's not going away. We shouldn't be vilifying the companies or the farmers on the edge of the rainforest, but supporting them to do smarter, better. But it won't. It's not changing, and vilifying all biofuels because of those relationships would be a poor decision to make. Yeah.
Okay. We've just about got to the hour mark. So, yeah. Charlie, any final points from you?
Well, just really thank you, Ryan. I found it most informative. I've certainly learnt a lot on this this discussion. I think our listeners will have done too. So really, from my point of view, thank you very much for answering some of the questions that have been rotating around in my mind over the subject. Thanks very much.
Well, Charlie, John, I feel honored and privileged to have met both of you and to be able to share some of this story. I think that the National Biodiesel Board representing farmers and producers is part of that story, but encourage us to think about things differently. So again, thank you so much for your time. And yeah. Stacey.
Yeah, thanks you. I mean, it's been a fascinating chat. We've raised a number of issues. I'm sure not everyone will agree with everything that we've talked about, as usual, but that's part of the fun. We'll do our best to edit out the sound glitch in the middle with our usual kind of semi-professional method. But yeah, thanks for joining us. We'll hopefully keep in touch and we'll chat again at some point, hopefully. Okay,
thank you. Thanks so much. Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.